Hello, hi friends, happy Friday, happy Friends of France Friday. I hope you all had a great sleep last night if you're listening to this early in the morning or in the afternoon. And if you're listening right before bedtime, I hope you have a great sleep ahead. Sleeping, it's such a dream, literally. I love to sleep, especially when I have to be awake at 4:30 a.m. or 5 a.m. for work. I wish I could just have the luxury of just going back to sleep and not worry about not getting paid because the dollars will just fall from a tree. Okay, Christian Franz, wake up. Literally and figuratively. Sorry for all the sleeping puns, but it's the center of our podcast topic today, so I cannot help myself. Please don't snooze me. Joking aside, sleep. I love to do it, but I must admit it's not my best friend. For as long as I can remember, ever since I was probably 5 years old from some of my earliest memories, I have always had a hard time falling asleep. Sometimes just rolling around the bed for an hour or two or even the whole night. My mind racing, thoughts endless, and I just find myself waking up somehow that morning. Tired, exhausted of course. But how long should one actually sleep to live life to the fullest by feeling great or even at the bare minimum, just feeling okay to function. According to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, or AASM, the Sleep Research Society, or SRS, and the National Sleep Foundation, NSF, adults should sleep at least 7 hours a night to promote optimal health. But over 1/4 of adults actually do not meet this recommendation. Oops, I'm raising my hand right now, me included. AASM states that about 30% of adults have symptoms of insomnia, and about 10% of adults have insomnia severe enough to cause daytime consequences. But why? Why is it that when we don't have enough sleep, it's so hard to function? What is it about sleep that it's so necessary for us to have the human experience of living? Why do we sleep? Is there a right way to fall asleep or be asleep? Do I really have insomnia, or is it simply because I have Wi-Fi and I'm too caught up on my Netflix dramas right before bedtime? In today's episode, we talk about it all. Sleeping, dreams, nightmares, the sleep cycle, sleep aids, sleep disorders like insomnia, sleep apnea, narcolepsy, restless leg syndrome, you name it, and so much more. It's just rightful to have a sleep expert with us, and so I am beyond honored to have Dr. Meredith Broderick, a triple board-certified sleep neurologist, fellowship trained in sleep disorders and behavioral sleep medicine, founder of boutique practice Sound Sleep Guru, assistant professor of neurology, sleep lab director, and medical advisory board of Oslo Sleep Buds to keep us awake tonight discussing these topics. You're in for a dream, so try not to snore. Have a good day.
Hello. Hi, Doc. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm so happy.
It's so excited for our live stream. We met at Dr. Sagai's celebratory party, and I was like, wow, this is the perfect timing, because since I started the podcast series almost 3 years ago, I need a sleep medicine physician. I was like, I don't know anybody, and then it just so happens that we met. So thank you so much for joining me today, Doc. If you could just first please introduce yourself to everyone. Thank you.
Sure. My name is Meredith Broderick, and I am a sleep medicine physician out in Seattle, Washington area. And yes, it was so great to meet you. There are so many good colleagues that were at that party for Dr. Sagai, which is amazing for his 1 million TikTok followers. Yeah, so I am a neurologist by training, and I have my own little boutique practice out here in the Northwest. And sleep medicine is
amazing. I feel like sleep medicine is such a niche specialty as well, right? A subspecialty. I think the first time I've ever heard of it was when I was still working bedside, and I think one of the discharge papers said, refer to a sleep medicine specialist. I was like, oh, there's such thing as sleep medicine. There's like, yeah, there's also lifestyle medicine and obesity medicine. It's just so interesting, I guess, throughout the years and decades, how subspecialized medicine is like becoming, which is great, right? I guess we're targeting so many issues that people need help with, right? I guess before, people were like, who do I go to for sleep problems? Like, is it a psychiatrist, a neurologist? Or I guess we have our own subset now. Well, I wanted to ask first your journey into medicine. What made you enter this field that's so long and entails so many sacrifices, like family, friends, or personal experience?
Yes. I think part of it was family, in that my mother was a professor at a medical school in town. And so grew up going into like the anatomy lab. And, you know, I think the first time I held a human brain in my hands, I was probably like 7 or 8 years old, pretty young. And also my grandfather had wanted to become a physician, and we, our family, have physicians going all the way back to like the Civil War times. I'm actually adopted by a family that, you know, part of our roots are in Missouri. And my mom's dad actually really wanted to be a physician, but ended up going off to fight in World War II and then sort of never followed through on his dream. And so it was interesting because my mom named me after a physician in our family. And so felt like
it was meant to be. I mean, I feel people outside of medicine or healthcare in general are really not aware regarding the road it takes to become a doctor, right? It's such a long road. It's 4 years of undergrad, X amount of years of residency, going anywhere from 3 to 7 years. And then if you do fellowship and subspecialize, and so much sacrifices involved, right? It can be financial and missing family and friends' birthdays and so much studying. At the end of it all, now that you have been practicing as an attending, having your own practice, do you have any regrets in pursuing this long, long field of medicine?
Right now, I feel pretty happy about it. But I'll tell you, I didn't always feel that way. And I questioned it a lot at times, because I think the main thing for me has been, you know, as a woman, delaying kids, you know, can result in some challenges in terms of having, you know, being able to have babies at an older age and things. I think I'm aware of that. And, you know, since I live in Seattle and there's a lot of tech here, you see a lot of people having success at a very young age. And you're like, wow, I was like just going into debt more and more at that age, right? And so you kind of, or, you know, even people who go into like financial, like investment making and stuff, you realize like it might not be the best way to become financially independent at a younger age. So I think there are some drawbacks, but right now, I feel pretty happy and satisfied.
Yeah, and speaking of love what you're doing, I guess, like I was saying, that sleep medicine is something that's so niche and subspecialized. So I know you did neurology residency, and then you did like a sleep medicine fellowship, right? Why neurology, and then why sleep medicine?
For me, part of the reason I chose neurology is I loved neuroscience, and I loved the neurological exam, and I loved how the diagnostic thinking part of being a neurologist, that really appealed to me. So mainly it was just the material. I really liked that area of medicine, and I really liked the thinking, the very cerebral nature of it. And then sleep medicine. So once I finally got into neurology, a lot of the residency training in neurology is inpatient. It's like stroke, neurology, neuro ICU, so people who have infections in their nervous system, like meningitis, or even people who have brain tumors and things like that. And so it's very acute. It's very like high pressure, life or death. People are really sick. And when I was doing that, I realized that it was really taking an emotional toll on me. I was really having a hard time with it. And so one of the faculty members at where I trained mentioned sleep medicine, and she said, you should do a visiting rotation at Stanford. That's like the place to go for sleep medicine fellowship. So I went there for 2 weeks, and it gave me so much hope about what I was seeing, because the sleep doctors were talking about preventing stroke, about preventing cardiovascular disease, mixing up a sleep disorder with a mental health disorder, and that being a misdiagnosis. But if you treat the sleep disorder, the person's mental health condition gets better. And so that whole preventative nature of it really appealed to me after seeing sort of the other side. And you can go into sleep medicine by many ways. You can be a as you mentioned, you can be a psychiatrist, you can be an ENT doc, you can be an internal medicine doc, you can be a lung doctor. So it also is a very multidisciplinary field. Dentists, orthodontists, surgeons, you know, we all work together. And so that really
appeals
to me about sleep medicine.
That's something with the whole interdisciplinary roles, but we'll talk in a little bit more. I mean, speaking of sleep now that we're veering into it, and I'm actually sitting in my bed, how timely is this? Well, I guess as a physician, I feel like sleep is something that you've been deprived of for quite a few you know, years of your life, right? In med school, especially residency and the hours. I guess just the act of sleeping in itself, why is it so important? Like, what is the function of sleep? Why do we have to you know, take a rest for these amount of hours at night? Like, where did this come from?
Yeah, it's interesting because there are a lot of theories about why we sleep. And I think some of it we're still figuring out. But the main one that we do know is, if you know a little bit of physiology, you'll know that there's what's called the blood-brain barrier. So there's no actual like around the brain. There's not blood around the brain. There's something called cerebrospinal fluid. And we think that during sleep is when our brain clears itself of metabolic waste. So as our cells metabolize energy, they produce waste, just like anything that's happening, any chemical reaction. And that's the time that our brain removes it and removes those like byproducts of those cellular reactions. So that's one thing. The brain is cleaning itself. And the other thing is that we're learning, we're consolidating memories, we're figuring out what do we need to hold on to, what can we get rid of. You know, we don't remember every single detail from every day. We, you know, remember what's important. And then we also create connections with our experience from the past so we can make new connections and build. And so learning is a big one, cleaning the brain from metabolic waste. And so it has this restorative process to it. Those are some of the big things that some people think there's a temperature regulation that might be playing a role because we do have this change in our temperature when we sleep. Some people think that energy conservation is part of it. It's a way to conserve energy by resting this, you know, third of our lives at nighttime when the sun goes down and it might be dangerous to be out in the world, which it is before electricity.
Yeah, so interesting. I mean, I read a book, I forgot what it was called before. I think it's called The Why We Sleep or something like that. And I know there's like so many, I guess, explanations and theories about why we sleep and all of the nuances about it. Now, when we're talking about sleep, I think in most things, I guess, in healthcare and medicine or about the body, we think of something like the optimal state, right? As a sleep specialist, is there an optimal hours that I should be sleeping? Or is it like dependent if we're talking to a child or someone in their 70s or whatnot?
Yes. You know, the average is going to be somewhere between 7 to 9 for most adults. Children definitely need more sleep, and probably into your early 20s, you probably need a little bit more than that. But for adults, it's going to be in the range of 7 to 9, and it does vary individually.
Yeah, I mean, outside of optimal, I think, regarding to the hours, I think a question that came a lot in my DMs when I started promoting our live stream is the idea of, you know, quality sleep. I guess for some people too, they could be sleeping maybe 7 hours, but they wake up still so tired and still groggy or whatnot. Is there such thing as a definition for like a parameter of what classifies as quality sleep?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are some subjective measures, like just things that people report, like whether they feel rested during the day, whether they had a lot of fragmentation, meaning like, did they wake up a lot during the night? But there are more objective measures we use, you know, so sleep efficiency is one data point we use. It's the percentage of time that someone's asleep that they're in bed, a ratio of the total sleep time over the time in bed. There are also other measures, like sometimes people look at the sleep architecture. That's where we look at the 4 stages of sleep and look at the percentages of those 4 stages and then how the pattern of how someone cycles throughout them through the night. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of an ideal pattern that we consider.
Yeah. Can you briefly talk about those 4 stages of sleep that you mentioned?
Sure. Yeah. So the 4 stages of sleep are divided into 2 types. There's non-REM sleep and REM sleep. And then non-REM sleep has 3 stages, 1, 2, and 3. And as you go from 1 to 2 to 3, it gets deeper. Mm-hmm. Deeper meaning it's harder to wake that person up. And then stage REM is the rapid eye movement sleep. That's when, you know, most of our dreaming occurs. And they have different characteristics based on when we record in sleep studies. We can distinguish them mainly through brain.
So interesting. But there are other things too. I think I saw a video before of, I was like, why is it called rapid eye movement? And I guess our eyes are literally like rapidly moving, right? And they're underneath it. It's like, this is so interesting and so scary as well.
Ever since I was a child, my inner arms and neck would always suffer from itchiness and irritation whenever I would sweat. It can become so debilitating, forcing myself not to scratch my skin and end up with wounds from prickly heat, especially at night. Thankfully, I have found relief through By Dr. Mom's Soothing Beta Cream and Soothing Bed Treatment, which uses barley-derived beta-glucan technology to help alleviate eczema, bug bites, and dry, itchy, irritated skin. Beta-glucan is a fiber shown in scientific studies to improve skin hydration and healing, and By Dr. Mom's products extract it with a technique that uses air technology, requiring no chemicals or solvents. Created by family physician Dr. Stephanie Liu with the help of an allergist and immunologist, you can now allow your skin to breathe and heal naturally. Using the code CHRISTIAN10, that's CHRISTIAN10, you can get 10% off your first order on bydrmom.com. As a healthcare worker, my identity can become so boxed within the pressures and expectations of my profession that sometimes I forget who I really am outside the hospital walls. This is why I find so much power and liberation in self-expression through fashion and accessories. And Lupin seeks to do the same. Encouraging self-confidence and creating a safe space to be yourself, Lupin seeks to share with the world simple and impactful jewelry pieces that can bring confidence effortlessly. Meaning what goes around comes around, the brand, comprised of third-generation jewelers, holds a mission to brighten the community by promoting positivity and a growth mindset. Lupin's clean designs are handcrafted in South Korea using 925 sterling silver, and can go with almost any outfit on anyone. In fact, I wear my pieces on and off shift. With the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ, you can get 15% off your first order on lupin.com. Let's bring more luster into the world, together with Lupin. I remember coming home every day from elementary school and smelling the newly steamed jasmine rice in the cooker that my grandmother made just in time for dinner. It reminded me of my first few years living on the farm back home in Asia, sniffing the rice while overlooking the fields. Founded in 2020, Bison Candle Co. hand-pours nostalgic and iconic scented soy wax candles inspired by the Asian scents, flavors, and traditions that founder Brandon Leung grew up with in his first-generation Chinese-American household. Brandon's mission with Bison is to create authentic Asian aromas while rediscovering his love of his Chinese culture and heritage. The candles and home fragrances celebrate aromatic Eastern flavors and aromas one would typically find in an Asian kitchen or pantry, like Vietnamese coffee, steamed white rice, and white peach. Enjoy traditional scents alongside some modern spin-off blends and be taken back into the beauty of the motherland with the code BAISUNFRANZ, that's BAISUNFRANZ, for 15% off your first order at BAISUNCANDLECO.com.
Also mentioned that, oh, when you get enough sleep, it's like kind of like set for the day, right? Like you're bound to have a good day if you have a good number of hours of sleep. And I want to focus on that aspect of the day, right? Like, oh, I sleep throughout the night and then I'm good for the day. But there are people who are what they call night owls, and they sleep in the day and they're like all up at night. And I guess people who also work night shift as well, outside of people who are just like, oh, I'm a night owl. Do we have data on sleep and the night versus the day? Are our bodies made to sleep for the night?
So we, in sleep medicine, they're called chronotypes. So we have what are called owl chronotypes, and then we have lark chronotypes. So larks are the early morning people. The owl chronotype is going to be more of a night owl. Most people are going to be kind of in the middle where they fit into like the culturally normal day. But we do have these outlying people that their preferential time or the time they're most alert is more in the morning, like an extreme morning, and then people who have more of a night owl tendency. And it has to do with the genetic traits. It can be influenced by environment, mainly light. And also it varies throughout our lifespan. So we all tend to have more of an owl tendency as we're in our teenage years. We usually shift more towards being a lark as we get older, which makes a lot of sense if you think about like young people like to go out, they like to stay up late and sleep in, and then, you know, the senior citizens are going for the early bird special, you know, so there's a reason for that.
Do we know of any possibly health impacts though? If let's say I sleep on the day versus the night, do you prefer if your patients sleep throughout the night as opposed to like the day?
So it really depends. So the main health risk is if, one, you're very irregular. So some days you're this way and some days you're not. So that's when it really becomes a health issue, is when you're sleeping, we call it out of phase with your circadian rhythm. So if you are a night owl, but you're always a night owl and you're still really regular, you go to bed at 4 a.m. and you get up at noon every day, you go to bed at 4 a.m, you get up. We don't necessarily think that that by itself, could that population of people who have that genetic risk be at a higher risk for certain conditions? People are very interested in studying that, and there may be some research, and I don't know how definitive it is, where, you know, there might be risks associated with that. But the real one is where there's that circadian misalignment, where someone really, their body wants to sleep, you know, at 4 a.m, but they're getting up at 4 a.m. to go into, you know, nursing is a huge occupational risk for like shift work, right? Because there's so many nurses that work night shift. So that's when it does become health risk. And we know that, for instance, like nurses have, you know, a higher risk of fertility issues, maybe even some kinds of cancer because of
I must say though that I used to work night shift, and most of the I guess older nurses that were on night shift with me, it's so interesting to see that we're taking hypertensive medications as opposed to those who were working in the day shift. I was like, we could do an actual research study on this in our unit. So yeah, it's so interesting. And you also mentioned about dreams earlier. I guess this can go into a spectrum of like very physiologic and scientific to something psychological like Freud, right? Do we know what's the purpose of dreaming? Why do we have dreams at night? And why do some maybe don't have, or they just don't remember, I guess?
Yeah, so we think that everybody dreams, and that, you know, one of the functions of dreaming is to sort through like the daytime experiences, put them into our memory, or make associations between other things that have happened to us in the past. We think that the reason why some people don't remember their dreams is because they don't have any awakenings during the dream. But if we were to like watch someone and wait for them to go into REM sleep and then wake them up and go, what were you dreaming about? Or were you dreaming, that people would remember better. So like the way REM sleep was discovered, this is actually what they did, is they would like hook up the electrodes, so then they would see the rapid eye movements, and then they would wake people up and they might see someone's eyes going like this, and the person would wake up and say they were, you know, watching a tennis match, you know? Sometimes just don't remember, but it is happening.
Dreams are just so weird, and it's just so interesting. Like, you can have the craziest dreams ever, and then there's dreams that make you hopeful, and there's dreams that make you wake up, like you run, and then there's dreams where you feel like you fell, and then you like suddenly jolt up, right? Dreams are just so interesting. Well, outside of dreams and outside of nightmares as well, I feel like sleep, as with any physiologic behavior that we have, I mean, the body's not perfect. There's disorders that come with it too, and you are the expert in this. In your office, or I guess just in sleep medicine as a whole, when it comes to bread and butter, would you say that there's like top three reasons why someone would see a sleep physician?
Yeah, snoring and sleep apnea is probably number one, directly or indirectly. So either the person's bed partner or family has concern about the person's snoring or breathing during sleep. Or, you know, they were diagnosed with high blood pressure and their cardiologist told them, like, you need to go see a sleep doctor because of that other health issue. I would say number two would probably be insomnia. So difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep. And then probably number three would be daytime sleepiness. So just feeling sleepy.
Got it. And I guess being tired. Just go through each, like, very briefly. Sleep apnea, when does snoring become kind of like, oh, I should see a doctor for this? You know, some people are like, oh, I snore when I'm tired. When would be that barometer of like, oh, this snoring is no longer just, I guess, a tired night, it's actually obstructive sleep apnea?
Yeah, so I think if you ask different sleep doctors or different doctors, you would get different opinions on this. But for me, anytime the snoring is an issue, they should come in. So if it's loud enough to bother a bed partner, you know, that raises my concern, because then it's affecting your partner's sleep too. If the person is waking up a lot or not feeling really rested and alert through the day, that's another reason to come in to see someone. We also think about like associated conditions like high blood pressure, migraines, depression. There are these other things where we just raises our suspicion a little bit. We want to screen for sleep apnea because all those things get better with, yeah. you know, identifying.
I must say, though, that sleep apnea can be quite scary. I mean, I've had a patient when I used to work in, I think I floated to the CTICU, and then one of my patients was on telemetry, and, you know, it has the respirations on it. And, like, every few minutes or so, I would get the apnea alert on the telemetry monitor. I was like, oh my gosh, why is my patient's respiration zero, like, every few minutes? And I was like, do you have sleep apnea? And they're like, no, I don't know, but I've been having this since I was a kid. So we actually got a sleep medicine physician to actually diagnose the patient. So it can actually be quite scary, right? I mean, going next to insomnia, I was going to send you a meme that I saw on my timeline the other day. It said, do I actually have insomnia or is it just Wi-Fi? So I think we've reached a point where people are just up on their phones at night. And I guess with the light as well, or I guess people's minds become busier with what they consume on their phones or on their computers. People don't get to sleep or watching their K-dramas like me, I guess. When is it that, I guess, as with the previous question, when is it a concern when, oh, I'm tossing and turning, it's just a bad night, or is it actually insomnia? I guess, how do you diagnose someone as an insomniac?
Yeah. Well, there's different types of insomnia, but the one that is kind of the bread and butter of sleep medicine practice is called chronic insomnia. And we think that you have to experience it more than 3 days a week for over 3 months. You know, so there's this kind of like normal difficulty sleeping that happens with life transitions, with stressors, that we think, you know, will pass. If you just wait, you know, the person will kind of solve whatever's on their mind and it will pass. But if it's very long standing and very frequent of that nature, that's when we definitely want someone to see a specialist. There's also a questionnaire that I use sometimes to get more an objective measure of how severe insomnia is, called the Insomnia Severity Index. Mm-hmm. And it's just a bunch of questions and you score it, and it can kind of tell you like if it's yeah. in the category.
Okay. And it's so difficult, right? I mean, if you can't sleep, it's like you're doomed for the rest of the day. It's like can't focus, your brain is cloudy and all of that. And I guess for the third one is daytime sleepiness. Is that the same thing as narcolepsy, or is narcolepsy just a more severe thing compared to daytime sleepiness?
Yeah, so daytime sleepiness is the most prominent symptom in narcolepsy, and then in a category of sleep disorders called primary hypersomnias. And that is like in what I would call the differential diagnosis of daytime sleepiness is a primary hypersomnia like narcolepsy. But of course, there are also other sleep disorders like what are called circadian rhythm sleep-wake disorders. There's also the sleep disordered breathing category. So that's really my job, is to take that symptom of daytime sleepiness and say what
got
is
it. Called.
In this world of social media that places so much physical critique and pressure on maintaining a youthful appearance against all environmental odds, the skincare and beauty industries have succumbed to a myriad of anti-aging practices. However, the covert fact is that beauty is timeless and that aging is a privilege. Regents, an inclusive wellness brand, seeks to promote this ritual of well-aging, understanding that it is connectivity with the body and attentive care given to it as it changes, including our skin. Founded by Filipino-American Gilio Rizzio, Regents introduces the all-encompassing serum, created to target the concerns of maturing melanated skin by utilizing a blend of healing botanicals used by our ancestors and select clinically proven active ingredients. From the brightening Ayurvedic licorice root to the soothing Centella asiatica and hydrating green algae, welcome to the journey of fueling skin health and enhancing, not changing, your natural shade. With the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ, you can get 15% off your first order on regentswellness.com. Experience the power of mixing native wisdom with modern day science. Do you have any guilty pleasures? I have one. Boba. Given that the average cafe-made milk tea has over 100 calories per serving, over 20 grams of high glycemic sugar, and is packed with artificial flavors, I am so glad that the guilty days are over with Twirl, the world's first canned plant-based milk tea. With only 45 to 50 calories per serving and containing 6 to 7 grams of low glycemic sweeteners, Twirl is made with pea milk, the most sustainable plant-based milk on the market, regenerating the soil where it comes from. Fairtrade and organic are the names of the game, as the teas are sourced from biodiverse family farms in China, Japan, and Taiwan that practice sustainable farming techniques. No artificial flavors are ever used. From four different flavors to ready-to-eat plant-based konjac and boba pearls, let's enjoy tasty, creamy, shelf-stable, and healthy milk tea together for 10% off using the code FRANZ10, that's FRANZ10, on twirlmilktea.com. Twirl around in its goodness. Growing up, I was ashamed of my Asian heritage. Classmates would comment about the lunch my grandma cooked, other kids would make fun of my eyes, and even some adults today would tell me to go back to where I came from. But where do I really belong? Who really am I? Am I not American enough? Highlighting the year of the first documented arrival of Asian Americans in North America, 1587 Sneakers seeks to shine the spotlight on Asian American stories and demonstrate to the world the extraordinary breadth of our passions and achievements. Made with full-grain natural Italian leather by footwear artisans, 100% biodegradable natural rubber outsole, calf leather interior lining for comfort and good smells, and wax cotton laces for longer-lasting cleanliness, these premium sneakers combine the highest quality, an array of timeless designs, and the movement to be authentically who you are. With the code FRANZ15, that's lowercase FRANZ15, you can get 15% off your first order on 1587sneakers.com. Step into embracing your identity without hiding. Express yourself unapologetically.
Now that we've talked about sleep and we've also talked about disorders in sleep, I guess the answer that people really want, right, is how do we fix these things? I guess someone comes up to you in your office, gets a consult, and it's like, doc, I'm having these problems with sleeping. What is your approach to that? Like, what modalities do you offer this patient? Is it medications right away?
No, definitely not medications right away. Just because medications are not always the best option. But so when my patients see me, I usually first do like a 60 to 75 minute consultation with them. And a lot of it is just talking and really getting to know and understand, one, the problem, the nature of the problem, two, their lifestyle, three, their medical history. And then, you know, as a physician, I kind of think of myself as like a pattern recognizer. We recognize patterns, right? And so I'm sort of able to start understanding, okay, these are the patterns that I see. It kind of fits with this, like either it's a sleep apnea or it's a combination. It's very common to see people with more than one to have sleep apnea. And so I might order a sleep study to confirm and to see what their breathing is like. I might have them wear a sleep tracker called Actigraphy to look at their sleep-wake patterns over more of like a 7-day period. I might have them keep a sleep diary. So I usually want to collect more data. And then that, you know, that experience that I have from working with people for a really long time can help me understand like, oh, this person's daytime sleepiness fits with this pattern. Like some people come with a story and you're like, that story sounds an awful lot like narcolepsy. I need to test you for narcolepsy. So that's my job, is to really communicate with people in a way that I can see what's wrong by talking to them and by collecting this additional data.
And I guess sleep problems have become kind of like an epidemic now, right? Across the nation, I guess, across the world. And, you know, people are desperate, like, to sleep, right? They're tired. They have things to do. They have work the next morning. They obviously, you know, can't function without sleep. And so I guess outside of sleep disorders becoming an epidemic in itself, I feel like people trying so many things to get to sleep has also become such a big practice, right? And I think a big part of that is melatonin, right? We see it as gummy bears, we see it as pills and tablets. I guess as a sleep doctor too, so many of your patients have, I guess, tried melatonin of its varying dosages. What do we know about melatonin? How safe is it to consume? Is it nightly or just for like a get over a jet lag?
Yeah, so melatonin is a hormone that's naturally made within our body by a little structure in our brain called the pineal gland. And what we're seeing in the sleep medicine community is, well, melatonin is actually generated in darkness. So when the light stops getting a signal that there's light, the pineal gland starts making it. So because of all this light, artificial light in our environment, like from screens and even electricity, like overhead lights, street lights, city lights, we're not making as much of it. And so we know, for instance, that we sleep about an hour less than our ancestors did, you know, 200 years ago. And we think that's because one of the reasons, because of light. So I think that's one of the reasons why people are reaching for melatonin is, like, I think somehow people know that, like, they're not making as much of it, right? So the problem in the U.S. is that melatonin is not a pharmaceutical grade product in the sense that there have been studies showing there's variable amounts in, like, you know, if you buy a brand, like, and it says 3 milligrams, there's not actually 3 milligrams in there, and there are other things in there. So that's one problem. I heard this year at the sleep meeting that there's also concern about that it can delay puberty if kids are part of it now. I don't know by how long, and I don't know that, like, you know, so if it's delaying puberty by a year, and I don't know what the statistic shows, but I don't know that that necessarily has any long-lasting consequence. On the other hand, melatonin is a potent antioxidant. It probably, maybe the reason it's delaying puberty is because it has an anti-aging property. I don't know, but in my mind, the real concern that I have about melatonin is that most people don't use it correctly. They use it in the way that could be really effective. And sometimes they're using it and they really need a different treatment. And so it's kind of like preventing them from getting
it. Yeah, and I guess outside of melatonin, the hormone, I think one more thing that I wanted to touch was, I guess, an electrolyte that I didn't really know actually supposedly helps for sleep. It's just magnesium. I know you created a post on this too. I mean, what have you seen with magnesium and sleep? Like, do you think it's better to get it, like, in supplement form, or should we rely on, like, our dietary sources for magnesium? And does it help with sleep at all?
Yes, it does help with sleep. So the post that you're talking about, when I researched that, what I found was that in the nutritional literature, that magnesium deficiency is becoming more common just because of our processed diet, because most of the magnesium we get, like, in terms of food consumption, is from green leafy vegetables, you know, and also they have to be raw to really absorb it. And so just aren't really eating that as much anymore. But I also read that the best way to absorb magnesium is actually from tap water. But if you think about how people are not, they're drinking all these, like, soft drinks and stuff and fancy drinks instead of tap water, like, they're probably not getting the minerals they need from the water. It probably depends where you live if you have magnesium in your water. So I think that's a real thing. As far as for sleep, I mean, the research doesn't really support taking it for, like, insomnia, let's say, but we do think magnesium deficiency can cause like these generalized sleep complaints. Like, when you measure the serum level of magnesium, it doesn't really represent what's going on in the body because it's mostly stored in our bones and tissue. But, like, leg cramps, restless legs, those are the sorts of things where we might try it and just see if it's helping. And of course, I think taking it, to answer a question, like, taking it as a supplement or food is good. The supplements can cause, like, magnesium citrate can cause diarrhea. So you have to think about that. I know for myself, like, when I looked into it, there are also some certain brands of water that do fortify the water with magnesium. So that's an option too, is to, if you can't, you know, get your tap water tested.
Got it. This is also helpful. I mean, my mind is just blown with some of the information that you're spitting right now, Doc, especially when it comes to melatonin. Well, I guess to end it all, I mean, again, sleep is becoming such an epidemic, and sleep is such an important thing, right? And even I myself, and I don't have enough sleep. I mean, I guess when I was way younger, I was so proud of, I can function with 3 hours of sleep every night. And I guess now as years came by, I was like, wow, I need like 6 or 7 hours of sleep. And as a sleep medicine physician, you see people who are struggling with so many sleep disorders of all types of things. And I guess to end it all, what would be your message to someone out there in the world who's, like, just struggling so much with sleep, and, you know, just their life is in shambles because they cannot sleep? What would be your message to that person as a sleep medicine expert?
I think my message would be that we can fix these things and we can correct them, and you can feel better.
I'm so surprised by all of this information. It's just such an interesting and such a niche field, and I just feel so honored to be able to talk to you today and get all of these nuggets of information. So Dr. Meredith, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You have a great rest of the day, that you get to rest finally and have a good sleep tonight.
Thank you. Bye. You too.